Hey, everybody. It's The Takeaway for Thursday, March 1st, 2018.
Indefinite was pretty much the status quo. I had arrived in a location where I believe one of the minimum terms of stay was probably about 5 years, and they didn't really have any end in sight.
Daniel Meyer is originally from Macau. He came to the United States with his parents when he was 3 years old. When he turned 18, he never applied for U.S. citizenship. And after getting into some trouble, he went to prison for armed robbery. He was eventually released on good behavior and then landed in immigration detention, as far as he knew, indefinitely.
And I actually got there at a certain time where somebody was actually battling their case through a writ of habeas corpus, because there really wasn't any options otherwise. There were no bond hearings, there were no options for a release through own recognizance. So they were just stuck in limbo. And when I arrived and I heard that story, I was essentially just waiting for the long haul. I really didn't see any end in sight then either. You know, I think a lot of people had the same thought that, you know, time really stops. They didn't really have any opportunities to, you know, go back and be with their families. They, you know, weren't able to help contribute. You know, a lot of them were really looking forward to seeing children that they haven't seen in a long time. And, you know, in general, I think that when they were stuck in limbo, they just kind of felt that there really is no, you know, there is no way of planning. They had kind of figured that when they were released from prison through their sentence, that they would be able to continue on with their life. And so the uncertainty of that was pretty stressful, and it put a lot of strain in their thoughts and what they were planning to do.
I'm Todd Zwillick, and today on The Takeaway, what rights do immigrants have when going through deportation in America? The Supreme Court ruled on Tuesday that some immigrants facing deportation don't have the automatic right to bond hearings while they're in custody. And that means some immigrants could face indefinite detention without the ability to go before a judge and argue for their release. As many as 36,000 immigrants are being held by U.S. immigration authorities at any one time. Several thousand of them could be directly affected by the justice's 5-3 decision here. Anil Callahan is a law professor at the Drexel University School of Law. Anil, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
The court ruled 5-3 against guaranteeing bond hearings for certain undocumented immigrants in detention. Anil, what exactly did the court say here?
So I think there's been some misunderstanding about the ruling. It's not quite as broad as some of the early reports have suggested. As you noted, there are some categories of non-citizens for whom Congress has sought to deviate from the normal principle that if the government wishes to detain them, they have to be given a chance in a bond hearing. And the lower court concluded that because this would raise significant constitutional concerns to have this categorical determination without any individualized assessment that people need to be detained, that there was enough ambiguity in the statutes to interpret them to require bond hearings once a certain point had been reached. And that point they had concluded was 6 months for these categories of people. The Supreme Court then concluded that that interpretation was not supported by the text of the statute, and Justice Alito did not resolve the constitutional question. So the lower court still will have a chance to decide whether there is a constitutional problem directly.
All right. Now, you mentioned some categories of people being detained by the government and what Congress intended. What categories of people are we talking about who could now potentially be detained indefinitely?
So the lower court had identified three different classes of people. The first one are people who are arriving non-citizens at the border, at a port of entry, some number of whom are asylum seekers, some number of whom may be returning lawful permanent residents. And the second category is people who Congress has identified a relatively long list of criminal convictions. If people have those criminal convictions, Congress has categorically said that those people must be detained, at least to some extent, again, without regard to these bond hearings. And then the third category, there are people who ordinarily would be entitled to a bond hearing, but then are held in detention for rather long periods of time. And the lower court had said that even those people may have had a bond hearing at time one, once a certain amount of time has passed, there's a need for periodic bond hearings to reassess whether the detention remains necessary. All of these categories of people, the classes that the lower court had identified was limited to people who had substantial defenses against removal. So either an asylum claim or some other kind of claim to relief from removal or that they should not be deported.
So let's get beyond the Supreme Court and what Congress intended for just a second, Anil. What exactly does this mean for non-U.S. citizens held in detention by immigration authorities?
Well, here's where I think some of the early reporting may have been a little bit overstated. For most people who are charged as potentially being deportable, they are individuals who have a chance for a bond hearing. That remains the default rule. These categories of people are not small, but I think it's important to recognize that not every non-citizen is covered by this set of categorical rules. They do number in the thousands. For many of them, the detention is quite prolonged. I think it will take some time for the lower courts to assess whether there's a constitutional problem. But this case is not the end of many people, and the other thing is that this case was limited to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Other circuits have similar rules, but they're not all implicated here. The lower court may well decide on a constitutional basis that the same outcome is required. And then the Supreme Court will have to decide whether they agree or not. But this decision is not the end of the road on this issue.
So, Anil, this case goes back down to the appeals courts, and they'll begin to decide on the constitutionality of holding people without an opportunity for a bond hearing. But put this in context of policy and politics. The Trump administration is trying to vastly expand its authority to deport people. The courts are separate from the White House and the executive, of course, but this is all going on at once.
It is all going on at once. And, you know, the Trump administration has, of course, sought to significantly expand the number of people who it is seeking to deport. It has proposed significant expansion in the use of detention rather than alternatives to detention, forms of supervised release, and so on. And the combination of those two facts means that it's quite likely that deportation proceedings will take longer. So we're likely to see a growing number of people subjected to detention for longer periods of time, really without regard to whether they need to be detained. And, you know, thinking about this from the government's perspective, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense for the government to spend thousands and thousands of dollars to detain somebody who is not a flight risk or a danger to public safety. It's quite striking that lots of people who were covered by the Rodriguez case that the Supreme Court just decided were given bond hearings, and an independent, individualized assessment yielded the result that there's no need to detain them. They will show up for their proceedings. They don't present any danger to public safety. We're likely to see lots and lots of people who really don't need to be detained, languishing in detention, likely for longer periods of time, if the Supreme Court's decision ends up being the last word on the subject.
Anil Callahan, law professor at Drexel University School of Law. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
At the top of the program today, we heard from Daniel Meyer. He lives in California, part of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Daniel is a non-U.S. citizen and has been held in immigration detention twice, once for a year and a half, and then again for 3 months. The first time was in 2000, the second time in 2015.
From my aspect, I felt that we were just bargaining chips. You know, without anybody really knowing, they just came in and started collecting people wherever they could. And I just happened to be one of those individuals caught up in that. In the sweep of the foreign nationals within, you know, the San Francisco Bay Area, me and 12 other individuals were picked up one morning. And, you know, I had gotten to a stage in my life where I really wasn't expecting this to happen. And, you know, I had just basically checked in 1 month before. So there was really no reason to believe there's anybody coming for me. And, you know, it came as a shock.
Was detention different, Daniel, from the first time you were in 14 years ago to the second time? Was it a different experience?
It was a definite different experience. On my first time going through immigration detention, this was pre-9/11, and so a lot of the conditions were different. I think they were more relaxed. They treated us more humanely. It didn't really feel like an extension of the current status quo, where it's like the prison industrial complex. They didn't have supermax lockups. They didn't have facilities that were completely closed off and movement completely controlled. This time around, it felt really different, and it felt like they did a lot of unnecessary things. And I don't know if it's for them to work on things where they generate more revenue for themselves or use up more of their budget internally. They did a lot of mass movements where they're constantly transferring people from one facility to the next, and every transfer basically implied that you're going to go through the same physical, you're going to go through the same medical evaluations, and regardless of whether or not your last evaluation was three, four days ago, you're going to go through the full battery. And so at first it seems like they're willing to take care of you and they're doing their part inside, but they're really not. You're no longer an individual. You're more like a number. It's two individuals per cell. You know, the cells are completely blocked off into little modules. It seems like there's a lot of expansion. It seems like everything is pretty much driven to housing more and more detainees as a way of generating revenue, it seems. I mean, I don't have all the facts and figures, but my general understanding is, it's a lot more revenue for them to house more individuals, or they may actually have agreements with the government to have a minimum amount of individuals detained at any given time. And that's exactly how it felt.
Well, Daniel, you have kind of a regular life now, right? You manage a recycling center, is that right?
That's correct.
You're from Macau, which, since you were first picked up way back in 2000, is now part of China. There's no deportation agreement between the United States and China. That sort of weighs on your case, I guess. But when you go to work every day, you come home, I mean, do you still worry that ICE could come for you again, that you could land in detention a third time?
I could. There's nothing I can see that actually prevents them from doing that. It just really depends on if they feel like I was a danger to society, or if they felt that maybe conditions are changing and, let's say, the relationship with China is probably improving and they may have some leverage to have them accept me back. But in between, if they felt like just detaining me just for their whim, I mean, there's really nothing preventing them. I just don't see the benefit in that, considering I believe being outside here and doing my regular routine is more beneficial to them, because I'm still paying taxes. I'm still, being a valuable member of the community. I still have my contributions, and I'm definitely not a danger to society. So I'd be shocked if they came by just for no reason, but it is definitely a possibility.
Daniel Meyer in Hayward, California. Daniel, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Let's go to Oakland, California now. There were 77 homicides in Oakland last year. That number's been dropping for the last few years, as it has in many U.S. cities. But every one of those 77 is a person with a story. And the radio program Snap Judgment set out, along with some local residents, to tell each and every one.
Majority of the homicides that we have in Oakland, California, are African-American young men that ran the streets of East Oakland. I call it a forward country, because if you don't know about East Oakland, then you might not survive in East Oakland.
That's Daryl Allums you're hearing there. Daryl is an Oakland resident and an anti-violence activist familiar to a lot of people around town. He was such a big part of the story that he wound up the co-host of Snap Judgment special episode called Counted, an Oakland Story. Adiza Egan was the lead producer.
There are still people who are dying every day, and what we wanted to do was put faces to those names and let people know who those people were and what they wanted and who they left behind.
Daryl, you're known around town because you become an activist against homicide in your town. People have seen you standing out on the street, sometimes with signs, yelling sometimes at the top of your lungs to get rid of homicides in Oakland. How did you get involved?
June 8th, 2016, there was two homicides, two young ladies. One name was Alexis, and the other name was Unique. They was killed 6 hours apart. 6 days later, there was a young lady named Regina Jeffries. She went to her friend's funeral where she praised dance at. 2 hours after the funeral, a fight that broke out between two African-American young boys, she was shot and killed at the candlelight vigil. At that time, enough was enough. Myself, my best friend, and my goddaughter, we started hitting the streets to end the gang wars right in the deep heart of East Oakland where the two main gangs were at. And we started yelling and screaming and started advocating and speaking to my nieces and my nephews about changing their lives. And the move become Stop Killing Our Kids.
Talk a little bit more about your message, Daryl, and what you say to people when they see you on the street or when you go to speak to them.
I get at my peoples in a very unique way, and that I'm able to relate to them. I come from the same cloth they came from, the gutter. I know what they going through because I was once them. Unfortunately, I was one of the ones that passed the torch to these young ones. So it's my job for me to get back in these streets to let them know what I did was wrong and what you're doing is wrong.
One of the first places that we met Daryl was at a church in West Oakland, and he had a poster board with pictures of children who had lost their lives. And from that point on, we connected with him and we worked with him to find people, talk to people, tell them what we were doing, and ask them if they were interested in being a part of this project.
So, Adiza, Daryl, a big part of your reporting here in your project is to tell the stories of each of these people who lost their lives in Oakland. Adiza, who was Jason Coleman?
Jason Coleman lived in a homeless encampment in North Oakland, and he had this very elaborate man cave. That's where he lived. They had wired internet, wired cable. And one day he was relaxing at home, and someone stole his bike, and he ran after the bike and was shot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we're a community. Shoot.
This is Jason's friend, Linda. She lives in the encampment in an RV with her dog.
He came riding on that little bike with a damn cart on the back.
You know, we go inside of this encampment. We learn a lot about the people and how they're interacting with each other and how they're supporting themselves, you know, amidst this crisis.
Daryl, tell me about Dominique Johnson.
2017, 2 days before Christmas, a young man by the name of Dominique Johnson was killed a block away from his organization headquarters, which is the Quilombo Center. Dominique Johnson was a community activist. He fought for lives, for justice, for young men across America that he never even met, shook a hand, or hugged. Dominique was a part of the African town. He helped with the African garden, planting, digging with his own bare hands. Dominique was a father. He was a brother. He was a friend to the community. And he was killed by gun violence. This was a very special homicide because it reminded me of me, but a younger version, out there in the streets, fighting for his people, supporting his loved ones, and then get killed by violence. It's a sad story.
Well, let's hear part of your episode where, Daryl, you actually go back to the spot where Dominique was killed and organize a neighborhood cleanup.
Damn world, baby.
Got the tents behind us over here. This is what Dominique did. He cleaned up the community, he fought for the community, and he took care of the community. So in honor of Dom, we out here doing that for the community today, for our village.
This the Dom movement. This his work. Got to continue his work. Continue his work, baby.
Adiza, tell me about Sultan Bey.
Sultan Bey is the son of a woman named Chef Mimi, and she's known around the city. She has a TV show called Bringing It to the Table. It's like a blacktop chef. And Sultan was killed in the front seat of his friend's car. They were in a parked car, and a bullet came in through the back and struck him in the head. And Chef Mimi talks a lot about how her son was bullied. He had been attacked before, and she just felt like he was at risk.
A lot of people I know have moved their son, their kids away, Arizona, Texas, and that's really, really sad. You know, that African-American boys are such at high risk living in Oakland. They don't have to be doing anything, no nothing on the line, nothing. Just get shot for no reason.
Adiza, 77 victims in Oakland in 2017, and you've cataloged them all for your special episode. What's next for your town? Is Oakland finding a way out of violence? Are people working on it in a systematic way there? What's going on?
Absolutely. There are so many people who work in the day, come home from their day jobs, and then go back out into the neighborhoods and are committed to this work. They're talking to people. They're cooking for people. They're just there to talk to. And, you know, we met so many of these people in this process, and it really gave me hope that this isn't something that people are just willing to wipe their hands of and, you know, just let it kind of fall to the wayside. Yes, you have gentrification and you have a lot of new development and people coming into Oakland, but I don't think, you know, these activists are going to let these people stay silent and let their voices not be amplified.
Adiza Egan, producer for Snap Judgment from Oakland, California. Adiza, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Daryl Allams, Oakland activist and host of the Snap Judgment episode Counted, an Oakland Story. Daryl, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
In 2016, 29-year-old Omar Mateen murdered 49 people in the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida. Mateen was killed by police during that massacre, but today, his widow Noor Salman stands trial on two federal charges, obstruction of justice and helping a terrorist. Jury selection starts today. Nadine Yanis is a reporter at News 6 WKMG-TV in Orlando, covering Noor Salman's trial.
After the shooting on June 12, 2016, they pick her up from their Fort Pierce home in Florida. FBI agents speak to her for several hours, and then she signs a Miranda waiver and gives this 12-page written confession. It's the most damning piece of evidence that we've seen so far, only because it has such explicit detail of how just days before Pol, she was with Mateen. They went to what she called Downtown Disney. It's now Disney Springs. She said that Mateen said, "What do you think would affect people more, a shooting here at a club, you know?" And then they went to Pulse. She says that they drove around Pulse for 20 minutes with the windows down. A lot of explicit details. In the confession, she says that she saw Mateen leave with a long gun and a bag of ammo. She also said that when he left, quote, "I knew that he was going to Orlando to attack the Pulse nightclub."
Well, Nadine, if Noor Salman admitted this much to police, why the trial here? Why not just a guilty plea? What are her lawyers saying?
Yeah, so this is also really interesting. Her defense just got documents unsealed yesterday. In it is some things that we knew, but we saw in black and white, where the defense is going to try to bring in two experts to talk about how Salman was severely abused, they say, at the hands of Mateen, and because of that, she was in fear for her life, and that may have played into why she acted the way she did before the attack. And then the second thing, they're going to bring in this Miami-based criminal psychologist, Dr. Bruce Frumkin. This guy specializes in false confessions. So that's going to play a key point, because in his documents that were released yesterday, it says that Salman, who they say grew up with some learning disabilities, has a high susceptibility of giving a false confession. And I think the reason why we may have not seen a plea deal is because the federal prosecutors feel like they have such a strong case. So it's going to be interesting how that all plays out.
Well, this was a very high profile and violent act. News all around the world, certainly news inundated Orlando when it happened. Is it going to be difficult to find jurors who can be impartial here?
Well, that's definitely what the defense says. Their attorneys the entire time during pretrial hearings kept telling me, "We just want a fair trial. We just want a fair trial." They put in a motion for a change of venue to maybe move it to Tampa or another district. That was denied, and that's because the federal prosecutors were able to convince the judge that they could find an untainted jury. So what they did was send out 1,000 jury questionnaires. It was 27 pages long with 76 questions, and 646 people physically came back to the courthouse to fill out these questionnaires. So we have 646 jurors that will be walking into the courthouse potentially today, and we're going to have to bring that down to 12 jurors with an alternate of 6. It's going to be a long process, but I got to tell you, this courthouse where the trial is happening is 1.7 miles away from the Pulse nightclub. So you have to factor that in when trial starts today.
Nadine Yanis with News 6, WKMG-TV in Orlando. Thanks.
No worries, Tom. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
North Korea has been shipping supplies to Syria that could be used to make chemical weapons. That's the conclusion of a report reported in the New York Times outlining details of a leaked report written by a panel of United Nations experts. Now, that report is getting attention not only for what it alleges between Syria and North Korea and chemical weapons, but also for its timing during a period of heightened tensions with North Korea. Christine Warmoth is director for the Adrian Arsht Center for Resilience at the Atlantic Council, also former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy at the Defense Department from 2014 to 2016.
It's a case where I think North Korea, you know, obviously is looking for sources of revenue given the sanctions regime that it's under. And the Assad regime is probably looking for help to try to rebuild the chemical weapons program that it largely shut down during the Obama administration.
And so assuming the report is accurate, what kinds of capabilities would North Korea be helping the Syrian government acquire here with these materials that they're allegedly sending over?
Well, from what I've seen of the report, it appears that it's helping the Syrians try to rebuild some of the manufacturing plants that it would have lost for its chemical weapons program. So this would essentially be potentially the kinds of materials that would be used to manufacture the chlorine gas that the Assad regime has continued to use, unfortunately, on the battlefield. It's things like heat-resistant tiles, you know, that would be used in the production process. Now, there are other production processes that also use those kinds of heat-resistant tiles. So the evidence that's laid out in the report is, you know, not 100% conclusive, but it seems to be largely manufacturing material.
Well, let's talk about motivations in terms of the timing of this report, because people have wondered why this UN report was compiled in the first place, then held back, then apparently leaked to the press. Would others have a motivation to accuse North Korea of this kind of international clandestine activity at a politically sensitive time for it? I guess the question is, why now with the release of this report?
Well, I think it is important to bear in mind that the United Nations does do these kinds of reports on a regular basis. The North Koreans are under a very extensive set of sanctions that are governed by UN Security Council resolutions. So the United Nations does have a, you know, normal and appropriate interest in tracking this kind of activity and laying it out and documenting it so that the UN member states can have a good understanding of whether North Korea is complying with the sanctions regime and, frankly, whether other countries are upholding the sanctions regime. Now, the fact that it's being leaked now is interesting. You know, I do think that certainly the Trump administration has been very focused on making the case for why North Korea is a very bad actor in the international community and why its nuclear weapons program and missile programs cannot be allowed to continue. So some might look at the timing of this and say, this is another example of the nefarious activity that the North Korean regime is up to and is another brick in the foundation of the case for why perhaps military action, you know, needs to be taken and why the maximum pressure campaign has to continue.
From where you sit, do you have any reason not to believe that North Korea is helping to supply Syria's chemical weapons program?
No. Sadly, I think, you know, whether the timing of this report is coincidental or intentional, I do think the facts and the substance that are laid out in the report are more than likely true. North Korea, again, has a long track record of proliferation. As heavy as the sanctions regime is, it's not 100% airtight. And North Korean ship captains have become quite adept over the years at trying to evade detection on the high seas. So I think it's entirely possible that much of what is in the report is quite accurate.
Christine Warmoth with the Atlantic Council, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy at the Defense Department. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Those are recovery workers digging with bare hands through rubble in Aleppo, Syria, looking for survivors of an airstrike. It's a scene repeated over and over in the documentary Last Men in Aleppo. The film follows a recovery group known as the White Helmets. 2015 and 2016 was a time of devastating violence in Aleppo, and the White Helmets are there trying to pull civilian survivors from buildings wrecked by airstrikes from the Assad regime and its Russian allies. The search for survivors often yields bodies, and the men digging have families of their own that any day could wind up under rubble just like that. To watch Last Men in Aleppo is to confront the relentless inhumanity of the war in Syria that goes on today. Faris Fayad is director of Last Men in Aleppo. His film is nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary. He's originally from Aleppo, but now lives outside of Syria. And I spoke with Faris ahead of Sunday's Oscars. He talked about what it means for the world to see his film while the war grinds on in Syria.
To understand the impact of the war, you have to see how much it's left destruction over society. And to know that, you have to be close from the Syrian families. And I choose Khaled because he's a father and I have two daughters. The same things I choose Mahmoud because he's a young man, a philosophy student, but also he left behind him his father and mother and with him his brother as a volunteer. So you can see how much this is difficult facing the everyday horror of the war. And in the same times, you are apart from the family and you have other responsibility between what you can do for your society and between what you can do for yourself and for your personal survive and for your family.
You spend so much time with Khaled and Mahmoud and their friends, their colleagues in the White Helmets, hours between bombings, missile attacks, digging bodies out of rubble, and then in between the moments where they talk and they talk about their lives and really the fact that they believe that they're doomed.
All this destruction is making it impossible to live in this country. The bombing, the ruins, it's unreal. It cannot be comprehended by humans or anything else. Imagine sitting at home and suddenly the entire building collapses. This is destruction on a massive scale. It's truly horrifying.
You said that this film is really about the Syrian people.
Yeah, I mean, not just about the White Helmets. This film is about the citizen of Syria, how the war impacts them. And I try, like, during the filming and working in this film from 2013 until end of 2016, try to catch the soul of the suffering or the problem that those Syrians face, their daily talk, their dreams, their fear, their nightmares. There is a lot of common things, not just between the Syrian themselves. Also, there is the common things with any citizen in any war and or any difficult situation.
For us, you've made this film. It's not only been shown in the West, but it's gotten accolades, Academy Award nomination. But it's a film that when you watch it, it makes it impossible to turn away from the carnage, from the human devastation in Syria. What do you want Americans to do after they see this film?
Yeah, actually, when I did this film, I didn't think about I'm doing this film for Western audience or for the Syrian themselves. I screened this film for Syrian, actually. I managed to screen. And the Syrian that when they watch this film, they have the same feeling that the American when they watch it. And they have the same feeling that the European when they watch it. They share the same feeling. They cry, they feel hopeless, they feel motivated to do something, and inside their mind, a lot of feeling of question about what they can do. Even they are a Syrian and they need somebody to help them. What I wish from the American that understand the problems, the refugee crisis, that behind this is refugees, there's a horrible war that destroyed the society, and understand that any decision from any politicians closing the border left the people killed without any help and put the pressure over the government to help more to stop this war. And that what my film is seeking for is like the peace and justice, peace in Syria. That means stopping the war directly, and there is real actions, not just talk.
Your film, of course, was made in Aleppo during the time of the devastation of that city by the Assad regime. We followed it here in the West from a distance. And over the last couple of days, we've been reporting on similar attacks in eastern Ghouta, in the outskirts of Damascus. Are the White Helmets operating in eastern Ghouta now? And can we assume that much the same scene is taking place there as is depicted in your film in Aleppo?
Yeah, it's the same scenario. The White Helmet, they facing every day, like between 15 to 25 bomb every day. But it's not just about the White Helmet. They listen in Aleppo that now the Russians and then the Assad regime, they bomb the hospitals and the center of the White Helmet because they want to destroy the resources. Because they learn from Aleppo that it's going to stop this society to continue. And most of the civilians who, and the volunteer who is working on helping the society. And nothing changed. Actually, from Aleppo until now, we said this is will not happen again, never again, but this is happen again. And we don't know what the next city will happen, that the same things, the same scenario for Aleppo. And that's actually, it's a big question about if there really somebody care and want to solve this problem. We're talking about more than 2,000 people killed just the last couple of week. That's a huge number. And the victim of this number is the children's, women's and men, civilians who never involved in any kind of the arms or conflict. And unfortunately, the only way is that to face this is power, keep speaking out, using the powerful of art and the power of freedom of expressions to stop that. To stop the war in Syria, we need to make films like Last Man in Aleppo and other films. We have to write stories and investigative stories and publish it.
Faris Fayad is director of Last Man in Aleppo. It's nominated for Best Documentary Film at the Oscars this Sunday. Faris Fayad, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being with us this hour on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's been more than 4 months since the Me Too movement erupted in this country. Since then, men accused of harassment have lost their jobs in many industries, some of them very public, like politics and media, and some very much less visible, like food service and academia. We asked you, have men lost their jobs in your workplace or industry, and did that open new opportunities for women?
Unfortunately, in my job, no one has been fired because of sexual harassment, to my knowledge. Being a teacher means that unless there's concrete proof, tenure and unions will protect everyone, even if they shouldn't be protected. This also creates a culture of stigma where women don't speak up because they feel like their voices won't be heard.
Hi, this is Bruce Plano, Texas. This question scares me. I hope we don't start accusing employees of harassment just to get their jobs.
A listener from Salt Lake City, Utah, wrote, "My company fired two supervisors, one for harassing a subordinate, the other for harassing a contractor. We replaced both of them with female staff." We want you, as always, to help us keep this conversation going. Tweet us. We're at The Takeaway. You can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. So, looking forward, one question is, as men leave their jobs or are fired for alleged sexual harassment, how many women are filling these roles? In the case of politics, women are vying for many of the newly opened positions. Jessica Bennett of the New York Times says her colleagues have coined a new term for this phenomenon.
The Me Too races. And the idea is that all over the country, there are resignations happening by nearly a dozen state and federal lawmakers who've had to step down due to accusations of sexual misconduct. And in their place are these special elections happening. And many of those special elections are now involving women who have decided to run. So there's this conversation, I think, happening more broadly about what happens when women, in fact, replace the men who have fallen.
That's the question Jessica Bennett of the New York Times brings to this week's conversation with Jezebel's editor-in-chief, Koa Beck. They join us most weeks to reflect on the elements of this Me Too moment as journalists at the heart of covering it.
This phenomenon of alleged predators being replaced by women exceeds politics and has been impacting other industries. Jessica, shall we take a look at a few of those?
Yeah. So I, in fact, had to put together a whole list last night because I don't think anyone's really been chronicling every single case, but there are so many. And they span from politics to the theater world to business and media. Christian Amanpour, who replaced Charlie Rose. Now, this is supposedly on an interim basis, but we will see what happens. Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith, who replaced Al Franken in the Senate. Hoda, who replaced Matt Lauer, of course, on the Today Show. Nicole Rudick, who was the managing editor of the Paris Review and stepped in as acting editor after Lauren Stein resigned on December 7th. You know, these go on and on and on. Ko, which cases have you been following?
The one that has been personally fascinating to me is the actress Robin Wright on House of Cards, in that her professional trajectory with the show, especially regarding gender, has predated Me Too. Long before Kevin Spacey was fired, she had come out against a pay disparity and been very vocal about the fact that she was being paid dramatically less than Kevin Spacey. And yet, if you go back and look at a lot of the reviews of House of Cards when it first came out, I mean, she was just lauded with praise for her, you know, Lady Macbeth nuance in Claire Underwood. So this idea that she's somehow not the star, or at the very least, not the co-star of the series, is laughable. And she apparently threatened to go public with the pay disparity if Netflix didn't reconsider it. And from what I know, they have not corrected it, or at least not given a statement saying that they have corrected it. After the allegations against Spacey came out and he was fired, it was announced not long after that Robin Wright would be the new star of House of Cards, which, for myself, as a viewer, as well as a lot of other women I know who watch it, she's always been the star. And so this, in a lot of ways, affirms her presence on the show and also crystallizes a new direction for the show, and that we're finally going to get the Claire Underwood show that we've wanted.
And, you know, does that matter? And does it change things to have a woman in power? It's too soon to tell whether this will lead to concrete changes within these organizations. But I think there are hints that it may. You know, organizations that have more women in power do better from almost every angle. They are more inclusive. They are more collaborative. They are ultimately more profitable. And companies that have more women in leadership positions actually have less of a problem with sexual harassment. But I think it's also important just from a kind of you can't be it if you can't see it standpoint.
Another important dimension of this conversation is that for a lot of my colleagues across media, per, you know, journalism, broadcast journalism, all fields, we are seeing very prominent men or men who are managers leaving our industries under these claims. And we do not have immediate resources to fill them while also approaching very difficult subject matter with less staff, less resources than we've known for a while. A lot of times in losing those hands to tell these stories, you have a number of women who are now having to work overtime, sleep under their desks, literally or metaphorically, to produce these stories in a way that is thoughtful and impactful. WNYC included. I mean, all these firings mean that other people have to work more.
It also, I think, means that women and people of color are being asked for their advice on these issues a lot,
yes,
or for their help in recruitment. This is a subject that is everywhere right now, and I think organizations, media, and otherwise are, for lack of a better word, desperate to bring more women and people of color in so that they can be on the right side of history. And what happens when that's the case? Well, a lot of times the work falls to the women and the people of color in those offices to make sure that we are handling these stories in the right way and to make sure that we are recruiting with not just white men in mind. And that term emotional labor has been used a lot in the press lately. This idea that women often simply take on more of the labor emotionally to solve for all of these things.
Yeah, and I also think that you and I have discussed before on this show about how some of these alleged predators are being removed without proper investigation or even being told what the allegations are. A concern I have, especially for a lot of these very, very accomplished women who are so remarkable in their field is that another component of them being hired is optics.
Right.
And this idea that they are, quote unquote, women friendly, as if that nullifies having had a predator in place for as many years as these men have been in place. One prominent female hire is not going to undo that.
Interesting that without any public calls for it, really, organizations have chosen, in most cases, to replace these men with women.
Mm-hmm.
Do they need to be replaced with women? No, not necessarily. But certainly there are plenty of accomplished women who have probably not been able to achieve those roles, in part because there are so few.
Jessica Bennett is gender editor of The New York Times, joined in conversation most weeks here on The Takeaway by Koa Beck, editor-in-chief of Jezebel. You can find all of their conversations at thetakeaway.org/MeTooMemos. And we still want to hear from you. Have men lost their jobs in your workplace or industry? Did that open new opportunities for women? Call us, 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll include your responses in The Takeaway podcast. You can subscribe at iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you download your podcasts. In the meantime, thanks so much, as always, for being with us. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.